From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I discuss the legacy of Israel's Prime Minister and President Shimon Peres, who died this week, and President Obama's nomination of the first U.S. ambassador to Cuba in decades.
This is an effort by Obama to really try to reestablish those relationships to move forward, but it is a very tricky situation.
Then I'll talk with the University of Oklahoma's diplomat in residence, Rob Andrew. In seventh grade, he sent a letter to the Soviet consulate in San Francisco.
And I wrote something along the lines of, who do you people think you are, but can you send me some information about your country because I'm doing a book report on you?
He later became the political military officer at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. We'll talk about his career in the Foreign Service right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot. Rebecca Cruz, sad news this week that former president, former prime minister, former foreign minister Shimon Peres, a very important character in Israeli politics, passed away. And everybody's been reflecting. It's time for us to reflect on the impact Shimon Peres had on the development of the country and its foreign relations. Of course, Shimon Peres, as I mentioned, he held just about every cabinet position in the Israeli government. He was in politics for over 50 years, but he also won the Nobel Prize and worked very closely with the Palestinians, with Yasser Arafat during his time leading the Palestinian Liberation Organization to try to create peace between these two entities. So a lot of people expressing their sadness this week that Shimon Peres is gone. But what do we have to say about his legacy and the things that he's left to us?
Well, at 93, he really is kind of the last giant of Israel, the creation of the Israeli state, to pass away. He was there at the beginning, if you will. It's a very young country, and remarkably so, that many of the leaders that came to power in the late 1940s, early 1950s with Ben-Gurion, they stayed in power in some position or another for the next 50 years. It wasn't until Netanyahu in the late 1990s, mid-1990s, that you had a leader of Israel that was born after independence. So it was quite remarkable. He was actually born in Poland, moved to Israel, was part of the independence movement, and as you said, held a number of different positions. He is being mostly remembered as a dove or a peacemaker. He does have a Nobel Peace Prize for the Oslo Accords, along with the folks that you mentioned there. And a lot of dignitaries are going to go to this service. Obama has mentioned he's going. Hillary Clinton will be going. And Bill Clinton, who, of course, was president when he was awarded that prize. But there are some that are not remembering him as a dove, that he was actually a hawk, to use that term, beforehand, and maybe a little bit later as well. There was a particular incident in 1996 when he was running for re-election where a UN camp was bombed in Lebanon. Over 100 people, many of them children, were killed. Pretty ghastly situation there. So there are some people, particularly of Arab and Palestinian descent, that are probably not as sad about his passing as others.
Well, of course, his early days in the Israeli political scene were in military positions. He's actually was very involved in the nuclear program.
Does or does not exist.
That may or may not exist. But the not so transparent nuclear program in Israel, he was engaged early on in that. But, Shimon Peres, if we can remember one thing that he said, perhaps he said that peace, of course, is costly, but war costs more. And, whether we can see the Palestinians and the Israelis come together on this, it is at least a time to reflect on what Shimon Peres brought to that relationship and see how it develops. But let's move to another part of the world, Rebecca, and let's talk about Cuba. We haven't talked about Cuba in a while, but the normalization of relationship between Cuba and the United States is progressing. And this week, the United States has named an ambassador, a new ambassador to Cuba. We reopened our a mission there and embassy there. But this new ambassador, Jeffrey De Laurentiis, is a career Foreign Service officer, and he's been in Havana since 2014 working on this relationship. But this you know, development still remains controversial. You know, the fact that we're normalizing these relationships, a lot of people speaking out against the naming of an ambassador, somebody who would be there to promote U.S. interests in Cuba. So how are we to feel about this?
Well, this is the first nomination for an ambassador to Cuba in over 50 years. So we're talking about a significant amount of time. And it is, at this point, just a nomination. Whether this will actually be approved is somewhat, well, perhaps unlikely, because the Republicans have already come out saying that they are not likely to approve this person. But this is an effort by Obama to really try to push along the normalization that you mentioned, that after 50-some years, that it is time to reestablish those relationships, to move forward. But it is a very tricky situation, and there are populations within this country, particularly of Cuban descent, that have a problem with this, particularly older populations. Those happen to also be the populations that tend to vote. So someone like Marco Rubio has been very outspoken against this, and was, as this ambassador was nominated as well.
Of course, President Obama's response to that was that this isn't an indication of support for the Castro regime, or, you know, not some sort of indication that there should be regime change or at least behavior change in Cuba, but that we need to have somebody there representing U.S. interests. And so as commercial flights are returning, as cruise ships are returning, as Americans are traveling more and more to Cuba, having that representation there is perhaps really important.
Absolutely. We may be missing out if we don't have that representation there. If we think about the opening up, the infrastructure that needs to be built, the telecommunications that's going to be developed, there's going to be a lot of business interest in that country, and a lot of it will be from the United States. And so, yes, that is his argument, that we need to be represented there, and it needs to be on a more official level than it has been this past year.
All right, Rebecca. Well, thanks once again for being here, as always.
Thank you.
If you have any thoughts about these topics or any questions for Rebecca or me, let us know in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. We'll also respond to your comments on social media. Check us out on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, where you can find links to our past episodes and some of our digital content. I tweet at Suzette Corlott. Next, I'm joined by Rob Andrew. He's a longtime Foreign Service officer who's in the middle of his tenure as the University of Oklahoma's diplomat in residence. I'm Suzette Corlott, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. My guest this half hour is Rob Andrew. He's currently serving as the University of Oklahoma's diplomat in residence. He was born in Norman, but raised on the West Coast. He was a U.S. Army officer from 1989 until 2002 and earned the Army Commendation Medal for Valor during the First Gulf War. After 13 years as a soldier, he joined the Foreign Service and served in various roles at embassies in Mexico, Costa Rica, Sweden, and Russia. Rob Andrew, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Rob, you serve as our diplomat in residence, but let's talk a little bit about your diplomatic career. You've had some very interesting posts around the world. You've served in Sweden and Mexico and Russia and Costa Rica. And so, I mean, these are like very different locations, and you've worked on some very different issues, NATO and the European Union when you were in Sweden, and drug trafficking and those sorts of issues when you were in Latin America, and then obviously just defense and security policy regarding Russia. So tell us a little bit about your career, kind of how you got there, became that Foreign Service officer, and how you've managed to move around the world in a way that you've juggled all of these different issues and topics and countries.
Well, certainly, I'm happy to do that. Having a career internationally is something I kind of have always wanted to do. I was a military officer before I came into the Foreign Service. I had my first assignment was in Germany. You're actually looking at, so to speak, one of the last people to ever patrol the old east-west German border for the U.S. Army. So that really brought my attention to international issues. Later on in my military career, I was training to be what they call a foreign area officer, which is what you find in embassies as defense attachés and other people who support that. Well, I still loved the Army, but I was looking to do something a little bit different and to stay at embassies a little bit more full-time or as more as a career than what the military would allow me to do. So I took the Foreign Service test on a whim, and I passed it. I was invited to the orals, and I passed those. And poof, I became a brand new Foreign Service officer about 14 years ago. And I will say it was definitely the international background. My mother was Canadian, not that far from us, but nevertheless, that inspired me at a young age. My brother moved to Rhodesia and Zimbabwe and South Africa when I was actually, he's about 10 years older than me. So I've always been focused outside the country. So between my own family situation and my military background, that certainly set me up for a great foundation for an international career. In my Foreign Service career itself, I've had a varied, differing amounts of countries that I've been to. One would say, why aren't you just concentrating in one area? Well, there are a couple schools of thought at the State Department about Foreign Service officers. Some say, well, you should specialize in a region. Others say you might want to have a little bit more of a broad experience and have some expertise in more than one part of the world. So I certainly took that second part on. I had a great Spanish language background, so obviously Mexico and Costa Rica felt very comfortable for me to work down there in those various issues. In Mexico, I worked with visas and adjudicating visas. In Costa Rica, something completely different, working on counter-narcotics issues. It was a great job down there in Costa Rica. They're a great friend and ally of the U.S. in interdiction efforts. And then with the European side, with Russia and with Sweden, what I view as broadening my views, getting a little bit different viewpoint of the world. Of course, 7 continents in the world. There'd be many more places I would like to serve, but so far that's where I've been concentrating on.
I'm talking with Rob Andrew, the diplomat in residence at the University of Oklahoma. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about his career in the Foreign Service. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest, Rob Andrew, has spent 13 years in the Foreign Service at posts in Central America as well as Europe. He's currently OU's diplomat in residence and also works with several other states throughout the Central Plains. So in terms of the different posts that you've had, is there anything in particular that stands out to you in terms of like things that you've, I mean, I just have to think working in Moscow, for example, you know, has got to be, I've been to Russia a few times. It's like pretty exotic and interesting. And obviously the times at which you were there, pretty challenging times, but also Sweden is fascinating. Mexico. I mean, these are just, what sticks out to you? Or is this something that, you know, you're just like you can love and appreciate it all?
Well, all of the above. We'll start with Moscow very briefly here. I have to tell you that since I was a little kid, I'd been fascinated by the Soviet Union and Russia, more in the sense of who the heck are these guys who think that they can nuke us, you know, when I was a little kid type of thing. So when I was in the seventh grade in grade school, I wrote the Soviet consulate in San Francisco. I'm from California. And I said, and I wrote something along the lines of, who do you people think you are? But can you send me some information about your country because I'm doing a book report on you? And so that started my lifelong fascination with Russia, the Soviet Union. And really my tour in the Foreign Service was a culmination of that goal to better understand that country, its issues, our relationship with the Russians. As complicated and difficult as it is a necessary relationship, especially today with what is going on in the world, whether it's with Iran or Syria, or good cooperation with the International Space Station, I might add. So, yes, it's certainly an exotic environment in that sense, challenging environment, but nevertheless, it's a relationship that we have to have.
Well, you weren't kidding. Your global interest started at a very young age, and the fact that you knew at 7, who do you think you guys are that you think you can nuke us? That's great. Well, let's talk a little bit about the challenges of today's State Department. We were familiar with where most of us are familiar with the fact that the State Department struggles in some ways, funding-wise. They also have a huge, you know, mission to manage our diplomatic relations around the world for a country that has relations with countries around the world. We, you know, have interests around the world. We're a global player and globally active. How is it today that the State Department is managing its diplomatic relations? It's tough to see where the diplomacy is, and yet we know that it's happening on a daily basis. But what makes the news, what we see in the news, of course, are you know, wars in the Middle East and, you know, U.S. military engagement and, you know, our policing efforts and not so much the diplomatic engagement. So tell us a little bit about what the state of the State Department today and kind of some of the challenges they're facing.
That's a fantastic question. I think many people here in the United States really don't understand a lot of the efforts that go on behind the scenes. Remember, usually what makes the news are things like wars and challenges and failures, perhaps, where it really is the day-to-day practical diplomacy that our diplomats are doing to maintain relationships with some of our best friends. You know, it's just like a personal relationship. If you want to be a friend to somebody, you need to work on that. Or in a marriage. You work on your marriage all the time. It's very, very similar. I like to use those terms, and it's a challenge. So whether we're dealing with France or Russia or Vietnam or China or Syria, these are relationships that we have to continue to work on. In terms of some of the challenges, yes, I would certainly agree and would point out to former Secretary of Defense, not State, former Secretary of Defense Gates, when he mentioned that the State Department budget should be increased dramatically to help us achieve our foreign policy goals. When we go to a military solution, often it's a failure of diplomacy. And so I think we do a very good job at diplomacy, but certainly we could get a few more resources here and there to do that. I will just, if I can very briefly mention that, one of our challenges is also manning all of our consular issues, just taking care of Americans overseas or adjudicating visas. And we don't have enough Foreign Service officers to do that. So we've implemented a new program called Consular Fellows to try and get people to come into the department to help handle those issues and taking care of our clients overseas, which it includes some of the most difficult languages out there, such as Russian and Arabic and Mandarin Chinese. So these are challenges we face all the time. Despite all of those challenges, I think we do pretty well most of the time. Certainly, I give a lot of credit to Colin Powell when he was Secretary of State for getting a lot of resources into the State Department when it really had become it was lacking resources. I mean, when he came on board, Suzette, this is really interesting. In the year 2001, the first administration of the George W. Bush administration and Colin Powell, Secretary of State, we were still using Wang computers. Over half of our Foreign Service officers did not have access to the internet around the world. Even in the year 2000, most people did. So he brought a lot of changes. I would say that all of the secretaries of state since then, including Secretary Clinton and Secretary Kerry, did a good job in doing that as well.
That is really remarkable to hear that in 2001 there was the State Department was or the, that our diplomatic efforts around the world were that behind, despite the criticism I'm quite familiar with and people working well above their pay grade and that sort of thing. So it is a credit to the government that they've been able to update that. But I want to follow back up on something
Sure.
you said regarding relationships because I think I love the way that you put it that diplomacy is about building and maintaining and servicing, stewarding those relationships. What would you say, though, are some of the most difficult situations today, the most difficult relationships? I mean, we can maybe come up pretty quickly with things like Syria, for example, as you mentioned, but North Korea? I mean, how are we managing that situation in light of, you know, continued military movements there? China? How complicated is that? What would you rank as the top difficult relationships that we have to deal with?
Well, you've certainly named some of them. North Korea remains an issue, especially they continue to test weapon systems, ballistic missiles. Just a news article yesterday said that we can now nuke the U.S. So those are certainly challenges that we have to deal with. I mean, the rhetoric, I think, is a little bit stronger than their actual capabilities. But I think maybe some, you know, it doesn't make the headlines every day, but the six-party talks have been on and off, which include China and the two Koreas and Russia, the U.S., and it's North Korea certainly a challenge. China is a challenge. We think of the South China Sea island competition. Despite that, China is huge, the biggest economy in the world. Sometimes the U.S. is, sometimes China is, and that relationship is so deep we cannot ignore it. So certainly a challenge with China, but not, you know, not any type of challenge that we can't handle. We're up to that. We're up to working with the Chinese. Russia, Ukraine, certainly another issue. Ukraine is a part of the world where, you know, where we have a potential conflict between East and West, and that's never a good path to go down. So that one gets a lot of attention by Washington, of course, and our European allies. Certainly ISIS, terrorism, Iraq and Syria, ongoing issue. And by the way, let's not forget what we call our ongoing or longest war, which is Afghanistan. Still, things are not quite where they should be in Afghanistan. We're working very hard with our Afghan allies. So there's no dearth of challenges for diplomacy around the world. My job security is there.
Well, I'm certainly getting that message that that we definitely have our work cut out for us, the U.S. government, in terms of its diplomatic efforts. Thank you so much, Rob, for being here today, sharing your experience. I appreciate it.
Certainly a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Rob Andrew, the diplomat in residence at the University of Oklahoma. We have more information about his work in the Foreign Service on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with the support of OU's College of International Studies. Our research producer is Katie Holland, Audra Bruls writes our digital content, and Sam Dupre assembles the show. He's overseen by Brian Hardzinski, who edits our interviews. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Guerlat.